Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. From The Botany of Desire to The Joy of Cooking to Kitchen Confidential, books about food fill our bookshelves, if not literally our stomachs.
For Milwaukee sociologist Jennifer Jordan, it was her introduction to an heirloom tomato that piqued her interest on how food shapes culture, culture shapes food, and how both inform personal and cultural memory. Her newest book, Edible Memory, is the result. Jennifer Jordan joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
What possessed a sociologist to talk about heirloom foods? How do those two things tie together?
To me, the concept of an heirloom food itself really is a puzzle that begs to be solved. It's so strange when you kind of step back and think about it, because you take something incredibly perishable, a tomato, right, that can barely last a week on your windowsill, and somehow conceive of that as an heirloom, as something to hand down from one generation to the next. And I've always been interested in the connections between collective memory, our sort of shared understanding of the past, and the material world. So heirloom food and heirloom tomatoes, antique apples, these things in particular, seemed like a really great place to try to understand how we connect memories with that material world.
And how they overlap.
Absolutely, yeah.
You use a phrase in here a couple of times that I found fascinating, which was eating other people's memories.
And that phrase came up when I was getting some sort of editorial input from a friend. And it was suddenly such a useful way to think about the fact that for some people, a given food might be very exotic and very unfamiliar. And for other people, that may be precisely the kind of thing that reminds them of their childhood, that evokes, you know, pleasant memories or even traumatic memories, but that's connected to their own life history. So you can have the same thing, like a mango, for example. Mangoes are an heirloom for millions and millions of people. And yet in the U.S., they're relatively recently sort of made more available to more of us.
They were exotic for a long, long time. Yeah, I was an adult before I first had a mango.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the Northeast and there were no mangoes.
Mm-hmm. And I actually was an adult before I ever knowingly had an heirloom tomato, right? This isn't something that I grew up with. And so even then, when I eat an heirloom tomato, I'm eating someone else's memories. And that may be a tomato that was saved in one family's garden for many years and then became more widely available, more widely grown in the 80s or 90s. Or it could be something that maybe a farmer has been growing all along, but now has become more popular. But heirloom tomatoes certainly aren't a part of my own personal edible memory. But that idea of eating other people's memories and even the concept of edible memory itself, I think it has a very personal, individual element, but it also has a deeply social element. It is a thing that large groups of people also share and that kind of connect us to each other or maybe divide us from each other, but that become a part of how we understand our place in the world, too.
Where did you start with this book? Was it with the tomato that you started, or was there other things?
The research on the book began after I finished my last book and after I had gotten tenure and started thinking about, you know, it's a great privilege to think about what your new project is going to be. And so I had several different ideas kind of kicking around in my head. I knew I was going to do something, again, connecting the material world and memory, collective memory. And on the one hand, I was very curious about my own family's kind of culinary history. And in particular, I was thinking about the kitchen at my great-great-aunt's cattle ranch in Northern California. And this was a kind of an almost mythical kitchen in our family's stories. And it had a big cast iron enameled wood stove at its heart. And my great-great-aunt cooked for all of us. And there's sort of deep culinary memories and just familial memories connected to that place. So on the one hand, I was really interested in thinking about that place and what it meant and kind of gathering information. But I also, because I'm a sociologist, I realized that that wasn't just a story of one kitchen or of her garden, which I was also really interested in. As I started to kind of ask my own family questions about those spaces, I realized that these were also potentially sociological questions, that I could ask questions about lots and lots of kitchens and lots of gardens and how patterns emerge when you start to study, you know, thousands of kitchens and thousands of gardens and the kinds of patterns that they create.
The idea that the personal becomes universal.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And it was kind of that personal curiosity that sparked the initial questions. But then the book became very sociological. And I was looking at about 500 years of history and looking at thousands of newspaper articles and stacks of encyclopedias of food history and just obscure documents and popular books and all the information I could muster to try to understand how heirloom tomatoes and other heirloom foods emerged. But then that also turned into a question about how our tastes in food change over time. So our taste in food can feel so deep and personal and absolute and permanent. And yet we all know within our own lifetimes that our taste in food may change, right? The things that we like as adults that we hated as children, things we had never been exposed to. And then once you taste them, can't imagine not eating those things. And that happens in a much bigger way with whole societies. And so you take something like the tomato, which is a New World food, right? It comes originally from South America as a wild berry and then moves to Central America as a cultivated fruit. And then eventually in the late 15th, early 16th century, moves over to Europe where for about 200 years, in some cases even more, most people thought it was poisonous. So if we think of how beloved the tomato is now globally, right, and what an important part of global cooking it is, including just think of Spanish food or Italian food without the tomato, and how deep a part of identity it is, of just sort of conceptions of normal everyday cooking. And yet for two centuries, people thought, and even more, people thought this food was toxic. So there's a tremendous change in the taste that people have for a food. And there's this real ability of different foods to move in and out of popularity.
Do you think, from a sociological perspective, that one of the reasons people, maybe yourself, but others as well, are so interested in this kind of history and how in preserving these foods, protecting these foods, celebrating these foods, is that at least in the United States, we have what seems to be sort of a homogenous food culture, that there's so much big ag kind of food that we miss the variations and we miss maybe the regional differences?
That's hard for me to say. I think partly because I'm so deep into this that what I see is heterogeneity, right? Because I've spent years kind of researching these different pockets of culinary tradition and these kind of off-the-grid gardeners who are preserving these really important pockets of biodiversity. So what I see in the U.S. is absolutely this kind of homogenized standard set of food that is available. But at the same time, I see so many rich, vibrant projects where people are preserving both old genes in the form of tomatoes or apples, but also old recipes, old cooking traditions. And I feel like there is some expansion of that work going on. We can see it in the growth of urban farms and community gardens, but also very much in rural parts of this country. So I see a lot of diversity that's becoming, I think, increasingly available, at least in some situations, but deeply regional too.
You spend, I think it's at least one chapter in the book, talking about the problem with a lot of these heirloom varieties of foods is that they're not easily transportable. And that one of the reasons we have the kind of uniform tomato is because you can transport that. And when you're trying to feed large populations and make money, which is, of course, the other part of that, that's one of the reasons why we have the beefsteak tomato as opposed to all these various varieties. Do you see a way of those two things resolving? Because a lot of times, if you're going to eat that kind of heirloom stuff, you have to be very close to it.
That's right. Well, and that is what some people are now advocating, right? If we look at the drought in California right now, that we have a tremendous reliance on produce from California, the way that our economic and food systems have developed. And so there are people now advocating, even more than they have been in recent years, a switch to more local systems of production, of turning some of the acreage of corn and soy in the Midwest, for example, turning more of it back to the production of a wider array of produce so that we can have a local source for these kinds of foods. And I think that even with heirloom foods themselves, there's a continuum. So in that chapter, I talk a lot about stone fruit, right? About peaches, about plums, about these things that are incredibly fragile
and seasonal.
And deeply seasonal, right? The baby Crawford peach that shows up for about 2 weeks. And if you don't get it then you've got to wait a year to taste that flavor. So, but that's one extreme. And so there are lots of heirlooms that are, we've got turnips, we've got carrots, we've got potatoes, things that transport well, things that store well, apples as well, if you store them properly. And so I think it's important to sort of see these things, these foods occupying a continuum. And those plums were an extreme example that I used just to think about perishability and the issue of perishability.
And accessibility, the idea that we should have all foods accessible at all times.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
At least in this country, I think a lot of us think that way. You know, it doesn't matter that it's out of season. I want it.
That's right. And that's so far from how people ate for sort of most of human history and how many people still eat today. And if we think about it right now, this time of year, there's almost nothing available fresh, right? If we were living on a truly local seasonal diet right now here in Milwaukee, it would be really thin right about now.
For fresh things,
and we'd be living off of things that we had harvested last fall still, right? It's almost May, but we have a late start to the growing season up here, and it's chilly, and there's not a lot of sunshine right now, so it's going to take a little while, even for the wild things like dandelions and ramps that would have been the first sort of fresh nutrition for a lot of people, also in Europe, right? Dandelions are the kind of classic first green to eat in the spring. In the Middle Ages, they were sort of seen as a tonic, as a way to kind of get yourself up and running again.
Reinvigorated after winter.
Yeah, exactly. And right now, I was walking to work this morning and looking, I finally saw dandelions coming up and they're tiny. It would be tough to get a lot of nutrition out of them. I've seen some bloom on south-facing yards, but it's going to be a while before we can really eat of the land around here.
In doing this book, how has it changed the way you eat, or has it?
It has. It has made me much more tuned in, I think, to flavors and to that seasonality. And it's a fine line to walk, because I don't want to say, like, never eat a tomato outside of 2 months of the year when they're spectacular. But I can recognize some of that difference. And that's a privilege to have access to those kinds of tomatoes. And then with apples, too, I think it's easy for us to think, well, apples, they're kind of the same all year. What could the seasonality be? But there I've also really learned through Weston Orchards in New Berlin, the incredible range of apple flavors that exists. And I have a particularly favorite apple that's only available for a few weeks out of the year, which is not how we think of apples.
No, but which one is it?
It is I'm going to mispronounce it, I think, but it's the Calvia Blanc d'Hiver. It's a French apple, and it's hundreds of years old. And it has all the things I like about an apple, sort of crispness, a little bit tart, but not too tart, not a very thick skin. And it's also very beautiful to look at. But my apple taste may not be your apple taste. And I would say more broadly, the project made me realize even more than I maybe already thought that we really can always ask where, in a really big way, where does our food come from, right? My book asks kind of what are the stories behind food, but we can ask that question in many ways. You know, who last handled the apples or the strawberries that you're eating, right? Whose labor actually produced those foods? And then we can also ask about the genetic story. Where does that tomato or strawberry originate genetically? What is its history? Who first bred it or who first cultivated it? And asking those kinds of questions, I think, yields really important information, both about how the food system works, but also elements of our own kind of cultural history, too.
Well, Jennifer, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Jordan is a professor of sociology at UW-Milwaukee. She'll talk about her new book, Edible Memory, The Lure of Heirloom Tomatoes and Other Forgotten Foods, at Boswell Book Company Friday at 7 p.m. There is more information at WUWM.com. Thank you.